This is Molly Smith, host of From the Median. It is my pleasure to introduce to you Alex Schadenberg, president and founder of the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition. His topic is, euthanasia in any form is a euphemism for killing and must be prohibited.
Good afternoon. So I'm going to talk to you about euthanasia and assisted suicide. And in the United States, it's a very difficult topic right now because you may not realize, but there's a steamroller coming at you right now on this issue. And a lot of people aren't quite aware, but right now in the United States, you have assisted suicides legal in Oregon, state of Oregon, Washington State, and Vermont, as well as there was a recent court decision in New Mexico. That court decision might be appealed, so we haven't seen the appeal for that yet. But if it's not appealed, then it'll also be legal in New Mexico. And so we're going to go right into this issue, and I have a PowerPoint that has to be pulled up for me here in order to go through this presentation with you. Now, you need to know I'm a Canadian. Don't hold that against me, eh? And I've spoken throughout quite a few places in the U.S. and in Europe, all across Canada. And I'm the international chair of all the groups that are opposing euthanasia to suicide. The mention about Quebec, we missed a bullet in Quebec. The Quebec government called an election before they voted on the euthanasia bill, so temporarily it's gone, which was a great victory. But I'm going to tell you something else. You just had a great victory yesterday in New Hampshire. How many realize that? Probably nobody. Yesterday in New Hampshire, the New Hampshire House defeated a bill overwhelmingly on assisted suicide. It was HB 1325 by a vote of 219 to 66. Now, some of you might look at that number and say, well, that was probably a shoo-in. It actually wasn't a shoo-in at all. What happened is that people from across the U.S. who have already gotten involved in the issue and throughout the world started sending messages to those legislators in New Hampshire. And we put on such a big push with a set of talking points, etc. And we ended up really turning the tide in New Hampshire. Now, you have to understand that in the eastern U.S., last year they passed that bill in Vermont. So assisted suicide is legal in Vermont. So because of that, Compassion and Choices, who are the other side, that the ones who are pushing to legalize assisted suicide everywhere in the U.S., they are pushing hard in the eastern U.S. because they won in Vermont, and they see then Connecticut, New Hampshire, and they're working on New Jersey, and they're pushing in Massachusetts. And that's what they're doing, and they're well-funded, very well-funded, with money from major corporations. This is a juggernaut coming at us, and people need to be aware and join in, because the only way we're going to stop this is if we're united, we'll work together, and we stop it. You haven't seen it yet in Ohio, but I guarantee you, like everywhere else, you're going to see it here coming at you very soon. So basically, I also mentioned here that we were fortunate in New Hampshire because one of our international board members is Nancy Elliott, a former three-term representative of the New Hampshire State Legislature. She was the one who quarterbacked our battle in New Hampshire very successfully. And I think that's important. I'm just going to introduce you to a few people. There's myself with Kevin Fitzpatrick last month meeting Pope Francis. Kevin is a man with a disability. He's the leader of EPC Europe. Paul Russell is from Australia. He runs the group Hope Australia. Dr. Peter Saunders runs the group in the UK. And Nancy Elliott is from New Hampshire. There's a few others, but these are our key partners in crime. So let's go through this. Now, in Canada, they've been attempting to legalize euthanasia, whereas in Europe, they're pushing euthanasia, whereas in the United States is assisted suicide. So let's be very clear about this. They're very similar things, but I'm going to first explain what they are to you. Euthanasia is done by action or omission, but it's intentional to cause death. Not about accidental death, okay? It's intentional to cause death. So it's usually done by lethal injection. That's how it's usually done. It can be done in other ways, too. The point I say it's direct and it's intentional because you're going to hear from people all the time, well, you know, euthanasia happens all the time already. And I'm not saying these things don't happen. What I'm saying is that unless it's direct and it's intentional to cause death, it was not euthanasia, right? It might have been something else. It might have been double effect. Euthanasia is also often referred to as mercy killing, and it's a form of homicide. When I kill you, that makes it homicide, right? usually done to relieve suffering. Euthanasia is not. Now, there was a question about this morning, so I will go through with this very well with you. It's not withholding or withdrawing medical treatment. Treatment. I'm not talking about basic care, okay? I'm talking about when you withdraw medical treatment and someone were to die, they would die a natural death. That's not euthanasia, okay? It could be sometimes a double effect. It's not the proper use of large doses of pain-killing drugs. Can large doses of pain-killing drugs be abused? Yes. The proper use of large doses of pain-killing drugs to kill pain, if there were a double effect, meaning the person were to have accidentally died, that is not euthanasia or assisted suicide. And it's not the proper use of sedating a person. A lot of people will say to you, well, you know, we use these techniques today to sedate people. Is that not the same as euthanasia? And I can guarantee you that putting someone to sleep and doing it properly and not trying to kill them is very different from actually killing me. Okay? Very different. And we have to make these clear distinctions. And why I say it's not about... So we need to also define assisted suicide. So euthanasia is when I would kill you. Assisted suicide is usually done by a physician who then prescribes the lethal dose, but you technically take it yourself. So some people will say, well, isn't that a form of suicide? Well, in a sense, it is a form of suicide. The difference is somebody else is directly involved. So what makes euthanasia and assisted suicide similar is the fact that somebody else is directly involved with causing your death. The law doesn't say that you can't die. The law doesn't say that you can't kill yourself. And I'm not advocating for you to kill yourself in any way. The law doesn't say you can't do that. The law says I can't kill you and I can't be involved with killing you. That's what the law says. And it's a very good law to have that because, in fact, it's there to protect you. The law is there not to it doesn't deny you rights. The law is there to protect you. The law is there to protect you from others and from whoever might decide to want to end your life. So assisted suicide is, once again, direct. It's intentional. It's not about an accidental overdose. It is about a direct and intentional overdose to cause your death, and you take it for that purpose. The other side likes to call it aid in dying. Why do they call it aid in dying? Well, we've heard about language already. Aid in dying is a euphemism to make you feel better. If we talk about aid in dying, people say, well, that can't be so bad. It's aid in dying. Well, aid in dying to the other side means killing you. Aid in dying to you and I might mean receiving good palliative care, being cared for, but to the other side, it means killing you. So the other side has made sure that they've crafted the language in such a way to make you feel better about killing. That's why they talk about aid in dying. So we need to be clear about what this is, euthanasia, assisted suicide. Why do we need to be clear? Because the other side wants you confused. The other side does really, really well when you're confused. When you think it's something else, they win. Okay? So here's the point. Many bioethicists, including this Peter Singer, who you might have already heard about, and if you haven't, that's a whole other talk, believe that there's no difference between removing life-sustaining treatment or ending medical treatment and killing you. They think those things are identical. Now, why are they saying this? Because I can tell you clearly, from personal experience and from human experience, we know there's a difference between killing you and letting you die. When we say no to medical treatment, what happens to you? Now, it might be right to say no to medical treatment. You might be on your nearing death and it's not providing you any benefit. What happens? You may or may not die if we withdraw medical treatment. But sometimes you don't die. Sometimes you continue living. You may or may not die. But if you did die, what did you die of? Your medical condition. It's a natural death. We're all going to die in this room someday. They just want you to die much quicker. Okay? In the case of euthanasia or assisted suicide, what happens when you take a lethal dose? You are dead. Okay? And it's not natural. It is about poisoning you. You are dead. And it's usually done in a very effective way. There's a huge difference between killing and letting die. Now, why is this an important issue? Because the other side argues we do it every day already. Now, some things we do already that are abuses. That's correct. So let's understand. When things have happened today which were wrong, they were abuses. You don't have legal assisted suicide in this state. It's an abuse of the proper use when they do that. But if they're right and there's no difference between killing and letting die, then we ought to just legalize the whole thing and regulate it. That's what they're arguing. They're arguing there's no difference, so we'll just legalize it and regulate it. So you have to understand where they're all coming from. They're trying to redefine issues. This is about Bill 52 in Quebec. That's interesting. What they tried to do in Quebec, just so you know, and they're going to try it again after the election, is they tried to redefine euthanasia, which is lethal injection. They tried to call it health care. So what they're saying is, I'll just give you a quick explanation, because Canada and the U.S. is a little different. In the U.S., your criminal code, your criminal law is statewide. In Canada, it's federal, right? So Quebec, being a province, cannot change the law on euthanasia. So what they have, because in Canada, the province has control of health care, they decided, we're going to call lethal injection health care. Because then it's a provincial issue and not a federal issue. But we can go into this a lot more, but I don't think this is the issue today because I'm in the United States. So I'm going to talk about some stories with you. If you want to really understand this issue well, let's look at some of the stories. You might remember this story. Now, Belgium legalized euthanasia in 2002. So some of you might have seen this story in one of your, if you get LifeSite News or Life News, you might have seen this story. It's about the twins in Belgium who were born deaf. So they're not physically ill. They have no physical illness. But they were born deaf, and they were experiencing macular degeneration, so they are becoming blind. So in Belgium, you can have euthanasia for what they call psychological suffering. So they decided that going blind would be too great a psychological suffering for them, and they asked for euthanasia, and in the end, this Wim Disselman, who's a doctor in Belgium, sort of like the euthanasia guru, he killed them by euthanasia. So, when we're talking about euthanasia, were these people terminally ill? Because the other side says, oh, we're only talking about terminally ill people who are suffering. Were they physically suffering? No. Were they terminally ill? No. They claimed that going blind would make them experience too much psychological suffering. Well, last October, there was a Dutch news story. Now, how many of you are Dutch? Okay, I'm part Dutch. Okay. Anyway, I'm the only one. That's interesting. You're part... Oh, there you go. You might understand this if you're part Dutch. This woman asked for euthanasia because she was becoming blind. Remember, she's not physically ill. She's not deaf like the twins in Belgium. She's just going blind. That's all that's happening. She was obsessed with cleanliness. And she said it would be too great a psychological suffering not to know whether or not her clothes were clean. Now, how many of you are Dutch here? I can understand it a bit. But not for euthanasia. No. So she dies. Why? Because she considered that to be psychological suffering. Now, was she terminally ill? No. Was she physically ill? No. Was she actually physically suffering anyway? No. Is she dead? Yes. Go to the next. How does this affect my friend Amy Hasbrook? My friend Amy Hasbrook, she's actually an American. She lives in Quebec. She was born blind. So if blindness is a reason for euthanasia, then Amy Hasbrook qualifies for euthanasia. Her life is considered not worth living by somebody, so much so that if she were to ask for death, they would give it to her. Now, how does that affect our attitudes towards others? But this also brings up a whole other question. They say it's about autonomy, and that's the big lie. When is it autonomy when somebody else lethally injects me? That's euthanasia. Someone else lethally injects me. Further to that, not only did that person might have asked for it, that's true, but somebody else made the decision that they agreed that that person's life was not worth living and lethally injected them. So what does that do about the attitudes of that doctor towards people with a similar condition? We move on. What about this case in Belgium? Anne was a 44-year-old woman in Belgium who had anorexia nervosa. Terrible condition. And actually, in her case, she was going to this psychiatrist, and he was treating her for anorexia. He was considered a specialist in Belgium. Anne accused him, Dr. van der Eyken, of sexually exploiting her and several other of his patients. And Anne was very upset by this, and it didn't go well for Anne. You can actually Google these stories. You see that the whole thing, you can start Googling, you'll find a lot about this story. So what happened is that she claimed that the whole process created such psychological suffering for her that she wanted euthanasia. She died by euthanasia. Dr. van der Eyken, he's seeing patients again. So we have to understand what this is about and think this one through. Now you may say, well, that's Belgium. That wouldn't happen in America, right? That just wouldn't happen here. Well, you might be right. That could be true. But the point of it is once you introduce euthanasia or suicide into the system, really it's a matter of time for what other conditions fulfill that reason to kill you. Okay? Because in the case of Belgium, I guarantee you, in 2002, when they were legalizing euthanasia, they were not thinking of Anne with anorexia nervosa as being someone they would euthanize. That was not on their list of reasons for euthanasia. But over time, it becomes a reason for euthanasia. Well, now I talk about Tom Mortier. Dr. Tom Mortier is a gentleman who's a chemistry professor in Belgium. His mother died by euthanasia. That's a picture of his mother. His mother was a teacher, and when she retired, she did a lot of traveling. And so what happened is that when they were much younger, her husband had committed suicide. So that's sad, a very sad situation. And she did go through significant chronic depression throughout her life. But she did have another relationship that she had with a person, with a man. When that relationship broke up, she became so depressed that she wanted euthanasia. Now, Tom found out on April the 20th that his mother had died by euthanasia on April the 19th. She was not physically ill. She was not going blind. She was not going deaf. She was depressed. And in fact, Tom has found out a lot of information about this death. So in fact, her psychiatrist has said no. But she went to the euthanasia clinic that's in Belgium, which is run by Dr. Wim Disselman again. And he then had her go to a psychiatrist who said yes. And she dies by euthanasia. Now, again, in 2002, when Belgium legalized euthanasia, were they thinking of someone who's depressed? Obviously, it was probably treatable. In this case, it was even situational depression because it was really heavily brought on by the breakup of the relationship as being a reason for euthanasia. Remember, you can't come back from euthanasia. You're dead. Right? It's final. We move on. Well, they say to you, well, this is the argument the other side says. We can have assisted suicide, but we can do it safely. We can have safeguards. Right? That's what they argue. We can have assisted suicide, and we can have it with safeguards. So they're going to say to you, if you're against assisted suicide or euthanasia, in the case of the U.S., it's assisted suicide they're talking about, if you're against it, then you're imposing your morality on me. Because I want assisted suicide and you don't. So we can pass a law with safeguards so you don't have to worry about it. That's what they're arguing. We can have a little bit of assisted suicide for those who want it only. Well, let's look at this. In Oregon, Dr. Charles Benz, assisted suicide has been legal in Oregon since 1998. Quite a long time. A very long time. Dr. Benz had a 76-year-old patient who was a long-term patient of his. And Dr. Benz diagnosed his patient with cancer, and his patient became very depressed over the diagnosis. Dr. Benz then had sent his patient to a cancer specialist. The cancer specialist calls up Dr. Benz and says, because the law requires two signatures, two doctors to agree. So the doctor calls up, the cancer specialist calls up and says, Dr. Benz, are you willing to be the second person to sign the assisted suicide form? And Dr. Benz says to the doctor, no, my patient doesn't qualify according to Oregon law because my patient is depressed. Because if you read the Oregon statute, it says, you know, for reasons of depression, etc., you don't qualify. So they say that's a safeguard. It's going to protect you. They're going to protect you. His patient is dead 15 days later by assisted suicide. Why? That doctor simply called another doctor and got the signature. It doesn't matter that this was his long-term patient. Now, you may argue, oh, well, maybe the doctor didn't realize. No, Dr. Benz was quite clear. This is my patient. I saw my patient recently. My patient is depressed, does not qualify. So when they pass such a law, if you're depressed, you can't even be protected from the law because the doctors will simply go through. Now, how does the law work? This is a good time to give you this lesson about how the law works. Because every state has been giving us that they've been trying to legalize assisted suicide, They've been doing these Oregon-type clone bills. So they're very similar to that Oregon law. So how it works is the doctor needs to approve the request and have a second doctor also sign on. Now, we know from Compassion and Choices, who are the group on the other side, that most of the assisted suicides are done by them. They admit it. They say it in their fundraising letters. In fact, over 90% of them are done by them. So, in fact, it's the assisted suicide people who are doing the assisted suicides. Secondly, the second doctor, if a doctor says no, that doesn't stop it. They just need a second doctor. It doesn't matter who the doctor is. There could be three or four that are asked. It doesn't matter. They need one to say yes. Now, usually there wouldn't be a problem because, of course, Compassion and Choices, they have their list of doctors who they refer you to. And that list, of course, are pro-assisted suicide doctors, so it's not hard getting the second signature. When you die, now, first of all, then the doctor would prescribe assisted suicide, meaning you'd get your lethal dose. Does the doctor oversee the lethal dose? No. It goes to your house, and you might never be seen again by that doctor until after you're in the morgue. The doctor then has to write out the report. Okay? So the point is, the lethal dose has no overseeing. There's no third-party protection. So in the end, when the person died, if the person took the lethal dose, the question is, how did it happen? We don't know. Rarely is the doctor present. Rarely is there a witness present. But usually, there's a Compassionate Choices volunteer present. And you're supposed to feel safe. Well, even in this case, it couldn't protect him. Well, what about Barbara Wagner? Well, you've had health care changes in the U.S. in a big way, so this story probably even is more concerning now than it was in 2008 when this story came up. Barbara Wagner was living in Oregon, where assisted suicide is legal. She had recurrent lung cancer. Was not a good case. She was prescribed an aggressive cancer treatment, which was very expensive. Now, so here's the issue. Does the state have the right to deny her that treatment? Well, she was dependent on the state health plan. So we can argue that till we're blue in the face. I'm just going to say that at that time, certainly the state had the right to say no to the treatment. But the state then also, in saying no to the treatment, offered her assisted suicide. So what is the state doing offering somebody assisted suicide if this is all about free choice? Because the other side says, it's about your choice. It's only about free choice. It's only about autonomy. When is it free choice and autonomy when the state is offering you assisted suicide? It's not. That's the whole point. She said, to say to someone will pay for you to die but not pay for you to live, it's cruel. The point is very clear that it's very cheap to have assisted suicide. It's expensive sometimes to have treatment. She did die soon after, so it's not like... So the other side actually was called out on this because Barbara Combs-Lee, who's the leader of Compassion Choices, she wrote an article about this case saying, who was Barbara Wagner thinking she was, thinking that she had the right to extraordinary medical treatment? Well, in fact, that's not the issue at all. The issue is, what was the state doing offering her assisted suicide? That was the issue. In fact, she wasn't asking for extraordinary medical treatment. Her doctor had prescribed it. We go further. What about this case? And this really uncovers the issue of assisted suicide for you. And this is the case of Jeanette Hall. And this is a letter she wrote to an editor for November 28, 2012. In 2000, she says, I was diagnosed with cancer and told that I had 6 months to a year to live. She had voted in favor of assisted suicide during the referendum. She knew it was legal. She just didn't know how to get it. Right? She didn't know how to go about getting it. She wanted assisted suicide. She said, I did not want to suffer. I didn't want to do radiation. I wanted my doctor to help me. She wanted to die. But he didn't really answer me because he did not support assisted suicide. Instead, he encouraged me not to give up. And ultimately, she decided to fight the cancer. She took the radiation treatment, etc. She went into remission. She's alive today. But here's the point of the story. She says, I'm so happy to be alive. It's 12 years later. If my doctor had believed in assisted suicide, I would be dead. The only reason she's alive is because her doctor did not believe in assisted suicide. So once you legalize this, the doctors who believe in assisted suicide, they're not only taking away one's hope, this woman was afraid of what her prognosis was, what her future was. But for further to that, it's basically a decision by somebody else that I agree your life is not worth living. I agree your life is not worth living. Well, in Canada, we had this case of Dr. Donald Lowe. Dr. Donald Lowe was a fairly famous doctor in Canada, but what made him even more famous was his wife was a health editor for the CBC, and the CBC is Canada's national broadcaster. So, you know, when Dr. Donald Lowe, when he died, soon after his death, they released a video of him 1 week before he died, and it went viral everywhere in Canada. And he died of a fairly aggressive form of brain cancer. But in the end, you know, in his video, he even admitted that he wasn't in pain. So it wasn't an issue of pain for him. But he said in his video, if you were to live in my body for 24 hours, you would change your mind on assisted suicide. Meaning if you had to live like me, you'd be in favor. Okay, that was his argument. So this disabled person from Hamilton, he responded. He said, I was born with cerebral palsy and I've lived all my life with pain. My condition is deteriorating. I now have scoliosis, which has given me further pain. My prognosis is living in a wheelchair. So in other words, he's saying, I do live in your body. I have a hernia, but because it isn't permanent, I don't qualify to receive help to clean my apartment. Living with a disability also means I have experienced discrimination. Most people with disabilities generally live with pain, suffering, and social isolation. I'm going to mention about disabilities. The one thing about disabilities is people define disability as suffering. We say, well, we wouldn't want to live like that. So when they're talking about euthanasia or assisted suicide, and the reason for it is to eliminate suffering, right off the bat, when you read most of these bills, it includes people with disabilities like Steve Passmore. Legalizing euthanasia or assisted suicide, he said, is an abandonment of me as a person, that society should rather help me die than help me live. The concept of euthanasia creates great fear for me. The answer is not legalizing euthanasia or assisted suicide, but rather improving social supports. He says, I only have one life to live. I choose to live. Society needs to ensure life with dignity, not death with dignity. And I think that was the right response to such a comment. But you see, that's what we're dealing with. Obviously, Dr. Lowe was a more extreme case. He had brain cancer. He also had an ability to have, after he died, his message go out all over the media because his wife was well-connected. So he had a great impact, sadly, on our country's debate on this issue. But his response is correct. It's not about you dying by dignity because, in fact, it's about living with dignity. We move on. So here's what I'm going to go through. I'm going to go through some studies with you, and then I'm going to take questions. So in Canada, Quebec, in the UK, and then there was this court decision in Canada. So we've had several major studies on euthanasia and assisted suicide, all done by the other side. The other side did them. They were very smart. They decided they're going to prove that there is no problem with euthanasia or assisted suicide. All these studies came and they said euthanasia or assisted suicide should be legal. These are all major studies. You can Google them. They come up. They're major studies that were done by the other side. In jurisdictions where it's legal, there's no adverse effects on vulnerable groups, and they say there's no proof of a slippery slope. So what they're saying to you is, if you oppose euthanasia or assisted suicide, it must be for religious reasons only, because, in fact, there's nothing wrong with it, and we've proven it. So we're going to move on. So we're going to look at some studies. Here's the first study we're going to look at, and this is a euthanasia in Belgium, and I think this one really opens people's eyes. What I've done is I've only taken the data from the study. None of this is mine. None of this is my language interpreting it. They looked at 6,927 deaths in the Flanders region of Belgium. So let me explain to you how they did the study. Everyone who died within a four-month period in the Flanders region of Belgium, the doctor who was the primary caregiver was sent a five-page questionnaire dealing with that person's death. So this is dealing with this person who died. It's an individual questionnaire. They got 3,623 responses. So this is on all deaths. All deaths, not just euthanasia, assisted suicide. From that data, which is an awful lot of data, they found 137 euthanasia deaths, 5 assisted suicide deaths, and 66 assisted deaths without request. That's huge. That's 208 assisted deaths. 66 of 208 were done without request. That's 32%. That's huge. That's huge. Now, the other side would argue with this data and say, well, you know, that's happening in Canada and the United States already, doctors making decisions. Well, let's think this one through, really, what happens after you legalize. So let's go to the next slide. Of those people, 91% of them had either coma or dementia of the 66 who died without request. So in other words, these are people who are in a hospital bed, who cannot ask for it, who are dying by lethal injection. That's huge. That's massive. And I listed some of the reasons. The study said 17% of the time the doctor thought it was in the best interest of the patient. 8% of the time there was no discussion at all because the doctor thought it would be harmful. We're not going to talk about it. We're just going to go ahead and do this. And nurses were more often involved in the administration of the drugs with euthanasia without explicit request. Now, what's important about that point is you look at that and say, well, what does that matter, Schadenberg? And I'll say, because the law says only doctors can do it. But the studies show that nurses were doing it. Okay, so what I'm pointing out to you, the law says this, but this happens. We move on. Who were the people who died? Well, they tended, so it said, the study said the use of life-ending drugs without an explicit request often involved patients with diseases other than cancer. So that's important because in Belgium, 80% of euthanasia is done to people with cancer. So these tended not to have cancer, and they tended to have an unpredictable end-of-life trajectory. This is important. They could not predict how long the person would have lived otherwise. In other words, they're bed blockers, right? They're bed blockers. And they tended to be over the age of 80 or older, mostly in coma or dementia, and it says, fits the description of a vulnerable patient group at risk of life-ending without request. So this is a Belgium study. It's done by people who support euthanasia, and the researchers are saying it fits the description of a vulnerable patient group at risk of life-ending without request. And what did, we'll go back a bit, the Royal Society of Canada say? Right here. And Justice Lynn Smith, I got to go back one more time. It says, one more time, boom. In jurisdictions where it's legal, there's no adverse effects on vulnerable groups. What did they miss? What did they miss? So let's go forward again. Sorry about that. I'm just wondering what they missed. Well, let's look at the study on the role of nurses. So this is a totally different study. New set of data. They questioned 1,678 nurses, sent questionnaires to 1,678 nurses, and got 1,265 responses. A lot of data. That's a good study. Very good study. 248 nurses reported that the last patient in their care died by euthanasia, and almost half of them, 120, said that the last patient who died in the care by euthanasia was without explicit request, meaning they did not ask for it. So here's the point. You're being told we're going to have euthanasia or assisted suicide become legal, and you should feel safe by this because we're going to have safeguards in place. So don't worry. And don't let your religious misgivings make you feel like this is a bad idea, because in fact the data says you're going to be fine, and that's what they're telling you. And when you look at the reality, guess what? People are dying without requests. It's part of the culture. 14 of the cases, the nurses admitted to injecting the patient, which is illegal in Belgium. Now, what's the point about this? You've got two separate studies, totally different set of data, different way of getting the data. You've got the same result. We move on. People who died by euthanasia without explicit request under the nurses' study tended to be over the age of 80 and die in the hospital. Same patient group. Same patient group. Who are they? They're people who are in a bed, and somebody wants that bed. Do you have that problem in the U.S. too? People are in a bed and somebody needs the bed. We have that problem in Canada. Lots of people in beds, and they're saying, we need those beds to be empty. Well, what are they doing? They're ending their lives. And then the study says, it seems that the current law, which does not allow nurses to administer life-ending drugs, and a control system does not prevent nurses from administering life-ending drugs. So the law doesn't allow them to do it, but they're doing it. Now, here's the thing. You would think, then, that there must be prosecutions. There must be something. There must be investigations. There must be prosecutions. There must be something going on. Is there any of that going on? Not one. Not one, even though the data shows there's a serious problem. Let's move on. This is another study, but it looked at the same data, the 3,623 responses. So it's the same study, but same data, but it looked at the question of reporting procedure, because all of these laws have a reporting procedure. So the idea is, well, the doctor has to report, so we're going to control this. Now let me ask you a question. In Oregon, Washington State, the Netherlands, Belgium, when do they do reporting and who does the reporting? It's an easy question. The doctor who killed you sends in the report after you are dead. So this isn't a reporting system that says you asked for assisted suicide, so we're going to send a third party in, some independent person, to actually question you to make sure that this is actually what you wanted, to make sure there's no elder abuse. It's not like that. What it is the doctor who's involved with the death sends in the report. Now, can I ask you a question? Do people self-report abuse? So when the other side comes to you and says, well, look at the Oregon stats in Oregon and Washington State. There doesn't seem to be very much abuse there. Well, I guess there's no problems. I guess we can have nirvana. We can have death, assisted suicide, and we can have safety because, look, there's no sign of abuse. But as I already told you, in Oregon, who's doing the assisted suicide? Compassion and Choices doctors. Compassion and Choices. Who's sending in the report? The doctors who did the death. Where are they getting their data from? The death sheets that are sent in from those doctors. Are they going to self-report abuse? No. It's not designed to protect you. Who is it designed to protect? The doctors. So you're being told you're imposing your morality on them, and you should just be comfortable because you'll be protected by the law, when in fact, you're not protected by the law. That doctor is protected by the law. Okay, in Belgium, 52.8% of those euthanasia deaths were reported. Now, this was 2010. Now, we've noticed a huge increase in the number of euthanasia deaths that are being reported in Belgium, partly because there's just a lot more euthanasia going on. But another reason might be, I haven't seen studies to prove otherwise, it might be that doctors are reporting a few more than they used to. But if you follow my blog, is anybody here who follows my blog other than me? Well, you should, because it's the worldwide blog. If you want to know what's going on in these issues all over the U.S., Canada, anywhere, you got to follow my blog. You got to get my emails. Dr. Cousins, who's one of the big euthanasia doctors in Belgium, he's been saying, I don't report any of my euthanasia deaths. I do it. I don't report. He says it's a personal matter between who? The doctor and the patient. Now, where have you heard that before? So he's saying to the media, I don't report any of my euthanasia deaths that I do. I just don't report. Now, has there been any attempted prosecution of Dr. Cousins? No. Is anybody calling for it? No. But even then, what's he actually doing? Someone said to me, well, that's murder. And I said, no. What he's doing is murder. He's just breaking a little rule of the law. He's not reporting it. Anyway, they don't report. Let's move on. Well, there's lots of reasons they don't report. Sometimes because they know they broke the law. 2.3% of the time they're saying, I don't report because I actually really did break the law. Some of the time it's because they think it's a private matter between the physician and the patient, just like Dr. Cousins said. They just don't report. Some of them said it's an administrative burden. They don't want to fill out the paperwork. Sometimes they thought that the legal due requirement had not been met, so they didn't feel like filling out the report, because if they filled out the report, it might show that the legal due requirement had not been met, which means they might get in trouble. So instead of getting in trouble, they don't report. So it's what you call a silent crime. No one knows. No one reported. No one followed up. And who were the ones who died when they didn't report? They tended to be over the age of 80, die in a hospital, same patient group being killed, the bed blockers. They tend not to report those deaths. And then the study went on further and it noticed that 73% of the time when they reported, the legal due requirements had been met, most of the time. Legal due requirements were only met 12% of the time when they didn't report. So in other words, the law is just a suggestion. And then the study concluded, legislation alone does not seem sufficient to reach the goal of transparency. I didn't write this, they wrote this. I just took it word for word. Total or 100% transparency seems to be a rather utopian ideal. So you're being told, we can have assisted suicide or euthanasia, in this case assisted suicide in the U.S. they're pushing, and you can feel safe because of our safeguards, But the studies show that that's really just a utopian ideal. We don't live in a utopia. We live with other human beings. Other human beings do things outside of the law. If they're going to kill you or be involved in killing you, maybe they'll decide not to worry about whether or not you wanted it. So when we look at these studies, what can we conclude? When examining these studies concerning the practice of euthanasia in Belgium, the role of nurses, one must conclude that not all is well in Belgium. Now, what did they just do in Belgium? What just happened? They extended it to children. Yeah. So what they're saying is, we're going to extend it to children, and we're not going to worry that the law is not being followed. It doesn't make a difference. And the fact of it is it says, oh, well, you know, the parent must agree if the child is only somewhat capable of making a decision. But, you know, often it's actually the parent who's the enemy in this case, sadly, sorry. Often it's the parent who wants the child to be dead, right? These laws do not protect people. They protect the doctors. So let's look at the Netherlands. I've been talking about Belgium. Why? Because there's lots of studies on Belgium. In the Netherlands, they've had similar issues, a little bit less. We used to talk about the Netherlands law because our early studies were all for the Netherlands, right? But now we know that in the Netherlands, they have 23% underreporting going on. So that's a little bit lower than Belgium, but still a significant issue. But, you know, what's funny about the other side is they keep saying, well, when we legalize, things sort of stay the same. It's not like it increases. This slippery slope argument doesn't make any sense. And I say, well, let's talk about then incremental extensions. It's incrementally extending, meaning there's now new reasons for the same thing, right? But in 2006, there was 1,923 euthanasia reported deaths in the Netherlands. In 2012, 4,088. I don't think that's a level. I think it's been going way up, way, way up. In 2013, they reported 45 euthanasia deaths in the Netherlands for psychiatric conditions. One was a 35-year-old woman with psychiatric problems. One was a 54-year-old woman with personality disorder, eating disorder, and excessive compulsive disorder. Good reason for euthanasia. Was she actually physically sick and dying? No. Another was a 63-year-old man who was physically healthy who became depressed after retiring from his work. He was not married, he had no meaningful relationships, and after retiring from his work, he said, I want to die by euthanasia. He died by euthanasia. Well, what about depression? Because don't we all become depressed, especially when we experience illness? Isn't it a natural human condition when you're experiencing illness to become depressed? And the answer to that is yes. So there was a study done by Vanderlee in the Netherlands, and this was done, it came out in 2005. I use this study because Vanderlee is rapidly pro-euthanasia, so there's no bias. She's very pro-euthanasia. What did she find? We'll move to the next slide. She found that, to our surprise, we found that a depressed mood was associated with more requests. Patients with a depressed mood were associated with a 4-time greater risk of requesting euthanasia, and a depression is a primary risk factor for requests for euthanasia. So depression is a primary risk factor. So basically, what are we saying? We're saying this is a serious, serious problem. You guys have to get more involved because this is about the assisted suicide in Switzerland. We're going to jump by because we're done. So what we need is we need more people to be aware of this problem that's coming at us. It's now legal in 3 states, possibly 4. Then there's the problem of Montana, where the court decision semi-legalized assisted suicide. And Compassion Choices is well-funded, and they're looking at every single state one at a time to legalize this. And we need to be ready for it. We need to be ready. We need to be more organized. They're trying to pick off right now Connecticut. New Hampshire was their last attempt. They failed. They had a referendum in 2012 in Massachusetts. You might remember that. We won that 51-49. People said, isn't it terrible it was that close? And I said, but we won. But that's awfully close, 51-49. The fact of it is this is a serious, serious problem. I have an email sign-up sheet. So if you go to the Cleveland Right to Life website, I got this email sign-up sheet. I do have my little book here you might want to buy, and I cover the studies very closely. So if you want to know a lot more about this information, it's in here. I sell this book for $20. And I also have some newsletters at the Cleveland Right to Life table you can have. But what you need to know is that this is not something that's coming at us 10 years from now. It's not coming at us 5 years from now. It's coming at us right now. And it just means your state hasn't been chosen yet for setting up their PAC to get going. That's all it means. And for us to win in these other states, we need others involved. We need others going at this. Because it isn't going to happen simply by saying it's not a good idea. Thank you very much.
Any questions? Do we have any time?
Oh, any questions? I'm like, yeah, lots. We have a little bit of time, but some of them are asked a couple of times. Tremendous information. Oh, my. And one of the questions wants to know about the HHS mandate, what you and I were just talking about in the hall. Okay, but a couple of them said that they've been told that if you don't donate your organs, you might be euthanized, and then someone else wants to know about organ donation. So the two issues must touch each other.
Okay, so the issue of organ donation is very touchy because people who sign their donor cards are doing so because they are altruistic. They want if their organs are healthy, they want the opportunity to help somebody else when they die. The problem with organ donation is the question is, are you dead when they take your organs? And so let's be brutally honest. You've already heard enough talks that you know that ethics have changed. And if you read the bioethics journals, you realize that the argument right now in the bioethics journals is not whether or not we should wait for your organs for you to be dead before taking your organs. They're arguing, well, because we don't already wait for you to be dead for your organs to be taken, why are we bothering with the dead donor rule at all? That's the debate that's going on that you don't realize unless you read the bioethics journals. So the fact of it is there's lots of reasons to understand about. I could go long in talking about how your heart, the issues of the heart and everything too. The fact of it is do you trust someone who's pro-death to take the organs out of your body and wait for you to be dead? Especially since healthy organs tend to be from living bodies.
Some are asking about the monetary gain for doctors performing euthanasia. What's driving this? Is it all about money?
It's all about a very twisted philosophy. The philosophy says that there are certain lives that are not worth living. They're going to argue to you it's all about choice, but choice isn't that simple. If I want to, okay, this is actually maybe a bad thing to say. For someone to actually want to kill themselves, is they might be mentally demented or something, but if they go ahead with it, it might have actually been their choice. I'm not saying it's a good idea. Of course not. But when somebody else is involved with killing me, is it simply about my choice now? No. Others are involved. Their values are involved. I mentioned about the blind people, people with disabilities and issues around that. Why? Because it's not simply about choice. That's the biggest lie. Further to that, when you find out you have a very serious condition, is it naturally that you're going to feel very down? Is it natural that you might think, because remember, this is not about pain. The studies have proven that this is not about immediate, this is about your fear of your future prognosis. People fear dying in great pain. They fear being abandoned. They fear being dependent on others. So they have these great fears, and isn't that natural to the human condition to have fear of these things? And everybody in this room probably has some of those fears. So therefore, the point is, once you legalize assisted suicide, you've totally changed the playing field because now someone can kill you when you're at your lowest point in your life.
Coming about depression, you mentioned that, and in talking about depression and fear and others involved, I want to get to this question about the HHS mandate. You and I were talking outside about a provision that is in Obamacare. We have read through the 2,000 pages, some folks, and we have found out what's in it. And one particular part of law is that the CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, have the ability to define what is legal for the mentally ill and the depressed and the psychotic. Can you address that? Or are you equipped to address what is in Obamacare?
Okay, so that's not necessarily my specific expertise, but I can tell you all the things you're talking about we already have in Canada, so that's nothing new to me. All these things about, you talk about the concept of possible death panels and issues like that, all this we already have. So the fact of it is that the HHS mandate becomes even more of of a problem if you've actually then legalized assisted suicide. Because now you have built into the system a situation not only that's discouraging you from receiving treatment when you have maybe a very difficult condition, but it will also then somehow lead to maybe encouraging you to say, yes, assisted suicide is a good idea. Because you have to understand the emotional nature of somebody in a very fragile time of their life. And when you throw assisted suicide into there at the same time as you're trying to control the amount of care you're offering, and it's not a nice brew.
We're going to get to some of these other questions. It's interesting, this panel. I've just received a lot of information about this mandate. There is a death panel in there for anyone that has problems with depression. They're depressant.
Yeah, we have that arranged in Canada.
Yeah, and a and for those that are psychotic, that go and kill others, they actually are reducing
all the medications,
including the brand name drugs.
I have to say something else. In Canada, we just got through a major court case about feeding, because remember, definitions are everything. And so you may not realize how healthcare is being defined, but in Quebec, they were trying to define lethal injection as healthcare. Well, just think about what they had to do is they were trying to redefine the word healthcare in the Healthcare Act in order to allow killing as part of healthcare. But in British Columbia, we just had a case, a family has a mother with Alzheimer's and they wanted to stop feeding her. Okay, you might have noticed the case. If you get my emails, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. It was the Bentley case. So the family asked that the British Columbia court redefine normal feeding. She wasn't on a feeding tube. She was being fed normally by spoon, and she was swallowing normally and sipping by cup normally and swallowing normally, and the family wanted the feeding stopped because of her Alzheimer's, right? So they went to the court and said, we want normal feeding by spoon to be defined as medical treatment so it can be withdrawn. Now think about this. Think about it. If you're going to define normal feeding as medical treatment, so I'm not even talking about tube feeding. We could talk about that issue for a whole hour also. But, I mean, normal feeding, if you define that as medical treatment, what about all the cases of people in our nursing homes who have certain stages of Alzheimer's and dementia and their family members who might not like what's going on because they say, isn't it terrible? Well, actually, if they visited mom more often, maybe they'd feel better about mom. But, I mean, the point of it is they're saying, they can then make the decision, if this case had gone through, to say no to feeding. They would have been able to do that to all these people who are normally feeding. I'm not talking about even tube feeding. I'm not even going that far. So just think about how definitions are so important, and then just think about your HHS mandate and all those definitions. Definitions are everything, okay? They're everything.
They really are. So is this deteriorating culture that we live in. When you think about narcissism and materialism, it leads to more not wanting to care about those that are aging and sickly among us. We said one more question, but someone wants to know about AARP and does it promote euthanasia? But the question that I thought of interest is, what are some of the names of major corporations that are pushing this euthanasia? Do you know of any in our country specifically?
Yeah, there's actually the list of funding has actually just been uncovered for Compassion Choices, and I can email it to you. But just think of George Soros and his and all related groups to George Soros. Soros is a major funder of the euthanasia lobby, the assisted suicide lobby, Compassion Choices. They're very well funded. They outfund us by a mile. And you know, the fact is that we just won in New Hampshire that they had full-time lobbyists working on it. When we lost in Vermont last year, they spent hundreds of thousands of dollars in Vermont with full-time lobbyists working away, and we were fighting it with a group of good people. So we just, at this point, because we don't have the money, we just need a lot of good people, a lot more. I need you guys on board who are getting the information and responding to it, because that's been our best weapon so far. The other side, as much as they have money and they're organized and they're committed to killing you, as much as they have that, they don't have the big numbers that we have. We have a lot of concerned people. We have to be willing to work together and employ that, because that has power. We do have power if we're willing to work together.
You have been listening to Alex Schadenberg, president and founder of the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition and 2014 Bringing America Back to Life Symposium speaker. This presentation was brought to you by Cleveland Right to Life, where through prayer, action, voting, and education, we are bringing America back to life.